A very busy show wraps up a very busy week on Friday, December 4th, 2020, on Connecticut Today. We're joined by former Bridgeport Democratic State Rep. Chris Caruso during a discussion about why cities like Bridgeport, Hartford, and New Haven tend to have areas where health care is not easily accessible, so-called health care deserts. Mike Shaw joined us, recently retired after 36 years as a conductor on Metro North. He talked about his brand new book. Brian Marks from the University of New Haven, economics and business professor, chatted with us about how much more money federal and state governments are going to need to get us through this coronavirus pandemic. And we wrapped up the show with Jan Hockadel. She's the president of the Connecticut chapter of the American Federation of Teachers, airing some of the concerns unionized teachers have in dealing with COVID-19. Chris Caruso's on the line. He wanted to chime in perhaps on my questions about a dearth of low-income health care. Or maybe Chris is just mad that the Senate won't take up the marijuana bill. It could be. Chris, is that what you're upset about, that Mitch McConnell won't legalize weed?
Not at all, Paul. And I'm going to tell you, and I'm being sincerely honest.
Yeah.
But my hand to Jesus.
Yes.
I have never smoked marijuana.
Well, you should start. You should start.
I had a very protective mother. I couldn't do anything, believe me. So I never did. So
Chris, I'm telling you, when the General Assembly finally legalizes it, go to, yeah, you won't have to go to a criminal anymore. You go to your local dispensary. I'm sure there'll be a few here in Bridgeport. You buy a couple, yeah, of joints. On the way home, you get a big freaking bag of Doritos and some Hawaiian Punch. And then you go home and call me on Monday and let me know how it goes. So anyway.
Hey, Paul, I wanted to let you know there were such incentives for different professions.
Okay.
For example, when there was a shortage of nurses, mm-hmm, the General Assembly passed legislation,
yeah,
where if a nurse, a person went through the nursing program, became a registered nurse, okay, and served as a nurse, they would get their tuition paid for.
I remember
they actually had to do service. Same thing with teachers, for example, and mm-hmm, that's how we got many teachers into the cities, because, again, if a period of time, then their loans would be forgiven. Now, let me tell you something that makes perfect sense, and when I was in the legislature, we could never pass it. I don't know if it's already happened or not. I had a friend, and I'll tell you his name. He's deceased, Dr. Wasserman.
Okay.
And Dr. Wasserman was a cardiologist. And when he retired from his practice, he went into the city and helped at the various health clinics.
Yep.
And he would do physicals and things of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
So he tells me one day, he says, Chris, I don't mind doing it. It's really good for me.
Yeah.
Gives me purpose, keeps me going. The only problem is, at that time, there's a $450 fee a year to renew their license, physicians.
Okay.
And he said, if there's a way the General Assembly could waive that fee but allow me to continue working in the cities, I would love to do that. And he said, I also know a lot of my friends that are physicians, colleagues, mm-hmm, that would do the same thing. Well, wouldn't you know, we could never get it passed.
Really?
And the interesting thing is, I have friends that are podiatrists. I have friends that are, primary doctors. And I bet you if we gave them an opportunity, they would come into the cities and practice medicine and do what they needed to do. The only thing that's holding them back is that fee, and partly because, when they retire, they're not bringing in income in anymore.
Yeah.
And you're expecting them to pay out a full fee that a practicing doctor would. So, I don't know if it's passed since then, but every year we tried to do it, we were blocked by it. And, lobbyists opposed it, and we could never get it passed. And I always felt bad. Dr. Wasserman, to the day he died, kept his license going and still worked in the, mm-hmm, the health clinics in Bridgeport to help people. But I just think what a tremendous resource, retired physicians, and many of them retire, the mid-60s, some early 70s.
Yeah.
could still give a lot to those local communities, especially in cities.
Yeah, you know? And Chris, it's just it's not just this, but you know, when I've heard over the past week or so, and you've probably seen the same stories about, well, you know, we have these healthcare deserts. I mean, how is that possible in America, you know, a pandemic or not, in the year 2020, when it's been, you know, 55 years, almost 60 years since we started this whole urban renewal push? I don't, Chris, maybe I'm just a simpleton. I don't understand it.
No, I don't think you are, Paul. I think there's a couple of reasons. Number one, to practice medicine, you have to be a good student. You have to. It's a very tough rigor, and not every person is up to do that. Just to get through the pre-med courses, some people can't do it. I've spoken to professors who teach pre-med, and they said some of the kids just aren't up to it, can't even get through you know, basic chemistry. That's one area. The other thing is that the medical schools accept just a certain number of people.
Yeah.
So that's another block for getting, you know, young people into the system. And many of them, I know some of my doctors have had to go outside of the United States to go to medical school as a result. Some have gone to Italy, others have gone to Mexico, you know, different countries. So that's part of the problem, too. It's a very restrictive admission into these medical schools for a number of reasons, you know?
Yeah.
Chris, so there's a lot of things, you know?
Yeah, I do have problem. But Chris, good thoughts. Thank you so much, Chris Caruso, chiming in every time we have. Thanks, Chris. Every time we have topics that hit home in Bridgeport, good to hear from Chris. Yeah, my GP, who retired about 2 years ago after a good long career, and he had a wonderful reputation in the Wallingford-Meriden area. He went to school in Italy. Smart guy, but just either couldn't get into or couldn't get into the school he wanted to in the U.S. So, you know, he came home during the summers. He went to medical school in Italy. And yeah, you'd be amazed, folks, how many people do that. As Chris said, Mexico, Italy, other countries that, you know, have room that take Americans wanting to study to be physicians. If you, like me, for any length of time, whether it's intermittently or in the course of your work, used to, currently do, or will do again once this whole COVID thing gets out of here, ride Metro North, either on the Hudson, Harlem, or New Haven lines. Our next guest is going to be a great listen. The book is called My Rail Life, Stories of a Railroad Conductor. Michael Shaw is the guest. He just retired this past August after 36 years of being a conductor on Metro North. Mike, Paul here. Thanks for joining us. Bless you and congratulations on hanging it up. How are you?
Thank you very much, Paul. How are you?
I'm good. 36 years, Mike's a long time to be doing anything. Are you antsy in retirement already, or was 36 years enough?
No, definitely wasn't enough. I could have done it another 36 years. I really enjoyed it, but I wanted to spend some time with the family, and I say as much as I loved the railroad job, I love my family a little bit more, so I'm going to spend some time with them.
Now, during your 36 years, were you Hudson, Harlem, and New Haven lines all around, primarily one line or the other? Where did you work most of your runs?
Probably 30 of my 36 years, I worked New Haven line, New Haven to Grand Central.
Okay.
When you start out, you have no seniority, you work wherever you can. So I've worked everywhere, all the lines, everywhere on the railroad. But the last 30 years, New Haven, Grand Central is my home.
So until COVID slowed it down for everyone, Mike, you probably took my ticket or checked my electronic pass a number of times because, you know, I've been doing back and forth to New York City for a good 13 years or so. So we probably crossed paths. I'm glad you wrote this. And, Mike, I would see you and guys and gals like you that did this, and I would often sit back and say to myself, what a job, considering what you guys and gals, Mike Shaw, saw and still do see on a regular basis. What made you take some of these stories? I know you have about 70 or so in the book. They're short vignettes, easily readable. What made you do the book?
It's funny you say that, because I was I ran a lot of fundraisers and parties, and I always had like a hypnotist, and I had a comedian there. I brought in dwarfs. I did skits, whatever it took to entertain. And it was my retirement party, September 19th, and I just wanted to do something different for that. Mm-hmm. And it was back right before COVID, like December. I booked the hall, and I was just bought a laptop, and I started thinking of all the things I've been through, and I was like, this could be pretty funny if I wrote a book, because most of my friends and my family wouldn't believe I read a book, never mind wrote a book. So it was shocking to everybody.
First, before we get into the weird and wild stuff, Mike, I would imagine, and I know you allude to it in the book, over the 30 plus years, the amount of people, and I always thought about this when I would see you folks on the trains doing what you do, the amount of people, Mike, that you see every day, usually if a lot of people are working a 5-day week, Monday through Friday, or part of a weekend, whatever you were week, whenever you were working, you must have seen a generation and a half of people start off as junior players in some companies and actually watch them as they matured.
Yeah, yes, very much so. And it is in the book. One girl comes to mind. Her father used to ride out of Pelham every time,
yeah,
and every day, and he'd bring her on. I think it started with the bring your daughter to work day. And when that started, she would come on the train. She had to be 5-6 years old,
uh-huh,
and I'd punch her a happy face. And then one day, this girl gets on the train. She's like, "You don't remember me, but I wrote my," and I saw her. I was like, "Wow." She was like 18 years old and still riding the train, and she was commuting now. And I told her, I said, "Thank you for your continued support. Very nice of you."
Great stuff. Mike, hang on. We'll be right back with you. Got to do a little business. Name of the book is My Rail Life, Stories of a Railroad Conductor. Michael Shaw is the guest, just retired after 36 years on Metro North, primarily the New Haven, the Grand Central run, and everything in between. Traffic and weather together, then more with Michael Shaw coming up on WICC. And we continue with now retired Metro North conductor Michael Shaw. Name of the book is My Rail Life, Stories of a Railroad Conductor. And yeah, folks, there are some stories here, about 70 or so vignettes written up by Michael. But Michael, I must tell you, I love the reflective nature of this book and how you talk about just seeing things. And yeah, the strange things that happen and the people you meet, but seeing things and how you look at those people on the train, you know, as a reflection of society. And they're not always, as you noticed, as you noted in a couple of stories, they're not always what they seem to be on the surface.
Yeah, you know, I talk about it. I've learned a lot from that. And how to handle certain situations. Unfortunately, it takes probably a bad incident to learn from it. But you have people who are just, I always tell people these stories when they're new trainees or new conductors. I say, you know, you never know. That's my thing. You just don't know. You don't know what the person's going through. You don't know if they're trying to visit someone in the hospital, if they're trying to get a new job that they haven't had in 2 years. And they might be irritable and treat you the way you don't want to be treated, but they might be going a lot that you don't know about. So treat them no matter how they treat you, treat them with respect, treat them like you're wearing a uniform proudly, and just treat them as a good, kind person.
Being on some early morning and late night trains, I've seen more than once where you folks have had to deal with, you know, situations that could get nasty. I know that you radio ahead for, you know, maybe New York police or MTA police. But in the interim, you know, I've seen you guys and gals, as you say, try and, you know, work on situations and diffuse some situations. How did you learn that? Was there a situation or two where you said, okay, I've got to keep things calm as best I could?
When you weigh about 155 pounds and you're not the strongest person in the world, it's something you have to come up with. So I'm not really confrontational. I don't look for fights. I'm very good at getting out of them. I use humor. I use, like I said, respect. You know, if you talk to somebody in a calm manner, they're going to calm down, make eye contact. There's a whole bunch of things, but I just learned it to protect myself and also protect the customers, because you can't have somebody losing control and next thing you know, you got a battle on the train and someone's going to get hurt. Something's going to happen. That's not what they need. So.
And the problem is, too, this is New York City, into and out in Grand Central. And, Mike, I'm sure you probably were encountering several thousand people over this 36 years who maybe, I'm guessing, may have had a few too much to drink. I'm going out on a line, line here, Mike, but I'm guessing you encountered a few people who were feeling good, or maybe not, when you had to take their ticket.
Very, very many, and it's in the book too, but I told my wife, that I needed to do some research to be able to handle this. So I would go out pretty much every weekend and drink a lot. So I also felt that way, so I can deal with people like that. And it helped me a lot over the years. So I continue that, even though I'm not working there anymore. But, I enjoy going out, so I do know how to handle people who are in that situation, because I feel like it's a club and I might be part of that at times. So I'm very, very good with intoxicated people. Just at the end, the same way, you just calm, let them think that they're right no matter what they're saying, and they feel better about themselves. You know?
Any scary...
But it hasn't worked all the time. It hasn't worked all the time. We've had some good confrontations or bad, however you look.
Yeah, and you talk about certain times of the year as well, Mike, and I've been told this too by conductors. Parade days in New York City, and there's, in the summer and in the fall, there's a parade or a festival almost every weekend when, of course, we're not dealing with COVID. Those can get real interesting, can't they?
Yeah, my two favorite parades, three. Thanksgiving Day is probably my favorite parade to work, because it's just people going down for the parade. Everybody's like dressed up, just having a great time. Pride Day, you can't beat. I mean, Pride Day is just one of the best days. It's rainbows everywhere.
Yeah.
And same thing. People are just happy going down and back and just enjoying themselves.
Yeah.
And then obviously St. Patty's Day, it's in my blood. Irish Catholic. So it's definitely harder to work because of the alcohol and stuff like that, but just a day. I love, using green. St. Patty's Day is probably the hardest day to work for most conductors.
I have been told that, because I would get into conversations late night and talking to you folks on the train, and I asked them that right out. I said, what's the roughest day? And a lot of you folks didn't hesitate. I couldn't even finish the question, and they said, oh, St. Patrick's Day. No matter how many warnings you put out there, Mike, about no drinking on the train.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you bring a water bottle, you bring some fruity bottle in there, you don't know what's in it, so... You have an idea, but they cover it up pretty good.
What was, if you can indulge me here, what was maybe the one or two, if you have one or two, scariest moments, maybe? I mean, the train's moving. You can't just open the door and run off until you get to a platform. People are who they are. Were there one or two situations where you really had to diffuse something, and when that was over with, you went, wow, that was... I got out of that. Not personally for you, but just for people around the situation. Were there one or two of those that you always think of?
Yeah, there's a bunch of them. One of them I think of is this kid got on a train with a backpack on, and he had it on he turned it around. It was after 9/11, after all these, it was only like probably 6-7 years ago, actually. And he had it on the front of him, and he got on, he had headphones on. And he's just jumping up and down and just screaming like, la, 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 la. And we're like, oh, and people came running out of the car. And we go running into it, me and my other conductor, John, who is not 155 pounds. And the kid just looks like he's got something on there that's going to just explode. We call for the police. And they couldn't get there to like Stanford or something like that. And we just left Mount Vernon. So Big John was back there. He's like, not going to happen with this. So he opens the doors. John takes the kid. We both take him. And the kid is just screaming. And he's just fighting us. And we just push him on the platform, which is an illegal move by Metro North, to put your hands on someone. But at this point, it was needed to be done because he just looked like he was going to do some bad damage there. And we just put him out on the platform, called them, told them to get the local police and their shell, and they did. And he was arrested, but he had nothing. But it was a very scary moment for everybody.
Before we wrap,
physically threw him off. I probably didn't throw a lot of people off. He was one physically thrown off.
but you got to do it. But you and your coworkers, Mike, you did what you had to do to maintain the safety of the train.
Yeah, and more so the people. Yes, definitely the people.
Before I let you go, our morning show host here, Melissa Sheketoff on WICC, when I told her this morning on a little crosstalk we do, Mike, every day, she said, "Who's going to be on your show?" And I mentioned it. I mentioned this to her in your book. She wanted me to extend a personal, heartfelt apology because she went to Laurelton Hall in Milford, and she claimed. You know where this is going?
Oh, yes. I already know.
She claimed, Mike. I said, "Well, what am I apologizing to him? What are you apologizing for?" She said, "Oh, he'll know. He'll know." And apparently, Mike, is it true that the Laurelton girls were always a bit boisterous on the early morning runs? Is that true?
Unbelievable. They probably still are, but I haven't done those trains in a while. But it's funny because I knew one, and she was one of the worst ones I ever dealt with. And all of a sudden, my daughter walks in the house with this girl, and she's like, "Not your mom, it's me." I'm like, "You are hanging out with my daughter? No way."
So wait a minute. So this girl who you thought was a monster ends up being a friend of your daughter?
Oh, now we're friends all the time. So she laughed because in the end, she was like that as a freshman.
Yeah.
But when she got older, you know, they calmed down. But I ended up letting her sit in the cab. And she's got pictures wearing my hat and everything. She was kind of fun.
Oh, that's great. Okay, so now I've extended the Laurelton girl apology, courtesy of our morning show host. Hey, Mike, as we wrap up here, if somebody's listening, or maybe somebody considers it, saying, "Well, you know, I hear the benefits are good and the pay is pretty good, but I don't know if I want to just collect tickets and have to work 3 or 4 round trips a day. I don't know." What would you tell someone who is considering doing what you did for 36 years for the MTA? What would you tell them?
I would say if you love people, do it. You know, that if you got to love people, I always say they should hire the guy that, you know, welcomes people into Walmart. I love, you know, just good people who are enjoying life and just happy, because you're going to have times on the train where it's very late, overcrowded, everything. If you're not a people person, you're going to struggle with the job, and it's come off bad for our railroad and our, you know, our transportation in itself. So if you got somebody who's puts on a good show and makes the best of a bad situation, then go for the job. You'll love it. As of right now, we're lucky we can keep everybody working there now. But yes, definitely go for it.
Yeah, tough going. Well, Michael, thank you. Good luck in your retirement. Maybe we'll speak down the line. Name of the book is, and you can pick it up at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever you can find it, folks. My Rail Life, Stories of a Railroad Conductor, Michael Shaw, the guest. Mike, be good, and we'll talk down the road. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the time. Take care, everybody. Happy holidays.
Thank you, Mike. You too. Michael Shaw, My Rail Life, Stories of a Railroad Conductor. All right. Coming back, a gentleman we spoke to early on in the coronavirus pandemic about the economy locally, statewide, and the nation. A return visit from Dr. Brian Marks. He's a senior lecturer and executive director of the Entrepreneurship and Innovation Program at the University of New Haven. And Brian, Paul here again. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well, Paul. Thanks for inviting me back. I hope you're well.
I am. I'm huddled up here in my remote location, but all is good. I've got plenty of microwavable dinners, a lot of Diet Coke, and I'm good. That's all I need, Brian. I'm a simple guy. The numbers that you and I have talked about from your first time to now, job numbers weren't great today. On a state level, the governor has, by an executive order, extended some unemployment relief. The state will put up more money. The feds will counter that with a 3-to-1 match. businesses still struggling a bit. Where have we come, Brian, throughout this whole thing, and what do you see coming up?
Well, unfortunately, I'll say with the resurgence that we're experiencing with the coronavirus and the end of numerous relief packages, although the recent executive order from Governor Lamont is a breath of fresh air, given all that's been going on. Unfortunately, I hate to say it, we may have a winter of discontent, especially absent a meaningful federal relief package. You started off noting, in particular, the numbers, and I can't help myself being a little wonky here. I do have some of those numbers.
Sure.
So on a national level, we've seen a further a modest decline in unemployment to 6.7%. Again, I must remind your listeners, we still have that misclassification error in our reporting. So the unemployment number is over 7%. For the state of Connecticut, the last numbers we have are from October. November's numbers will come out in a couple of weeks. I mean, that number was 6.1%. But when you take into account the classification error, the unemployment in Connecticut is between really 10 and 11%.
Wow.
While directionally, again, the numbers are improving, there's significant weakness in the economy. We're confronted with our public health crisis, an economic-induced crisis, and a political crisis of gridlock in Washington. So when we look further into the numbers, we're seeing, unfortunately, permanent losses of 3.7 million jobs.
So those jobs, so 3.7 million jobs, you say, Brian, just to make a note here, because I think that's important, those jobs are never coming back, you think?
Well, it's viewed as permanent job losses.
Yeah,
it means they ultimately, as the economy restructures, we'll see employment start picking up, which we all hope and expect. It's a question of timing. But what's really interesting to keep our eyes on are the number of people who are actually leaving the labor force. And that number increased. So while we've been talking about an increase of jobs of about 245,000, of which economists had estimated it has been reported about 450,000. So we were short there.
Yeah.
But the number of people leaving the labor force is up to close to 450,000, leaving about 7.1 million leaving the labor force. So while we may see that slight decline in our unemployment number, it's partially due to people leaving the labor force no longer being counted.
Mm.
So add to that, our long-term, those who are out over 27 weeks, that number also increased to about 385,000. So we're now up to 3.9 million.
So it appears, Brian, that it looks like suddenly there may be a kumbaya moment or two in D.C. for at least $900 billion of more relief now. Maybe the House and the Senate will get together. But as you noted, and as a lot of people say, that's not going to be nearly enough. So assuming, let's say that something happens before the end of the current session of Congress, before the inauguration, heading into the first months of the Biden administration, Brian, how much more do you think, because I don't think we're ever going to pay this back, this is monopoly money, but we need it, how much more stimulus do you think is going to be needed?
I wish I had a crystal ball to tell you how much. I can agree with you that $908 billion, we could talk about that as a down payment, if you will. And we're going to have to look at it that way. I mean, back in the 2008 financial crisis, George W. Bush, his administration, and Congress at the time passed, if I recall correctly, over $750 billion. And the Obama administration came in and had to pass another piece of relief package, which wound up being about $1.5 trillion. The situation today is very different because of the public health crisis. Look, the bottom line is we need a bridge to carry us to a vaccine. And we need a bridge not only to carry us to the vaccine, but to carry us to its widespread distribution. And this is not going to occur within the next 30, 60 days. We're looking out optimistically. People are talking here June, but that's optimistic. So what do we need? We need a public health solution to get for this bridge, and that's continued social distancing, testing, contact tracing, and being conscientious on the public health front. And then what we need is, even though there were flaws in it, an extension, a replenishing, if you will, of the PPP, the Payroll Protection Program, a further extension of unemployment benefits. Governor Lamont, you know, Connecticut has had a rainy day fund. It has been building up. It appears he will be calling on that, which is positive for Connecticut. In fact, Connecticut is one of the few states that is well positioned from a rainy day fund. And I'll say I'm focusing on relief, not stimulus, but stimulus. We could see a need for more stimulus checks and a significant weakness. Overall, and I pointed out the state of Connecticut, is state and local government relief. Losses of revenues are quite significant, increasing of costs. All that is different when it's the federal government. State governments, local governments have budget constraints. It cannot call on the Fed and say, please lend me some money.
Exactly.
So, we're facing a great deal right now, and it's unfortunate where we are politically in the environment.
Brian, as always, great insights. Dr. Brian A. Marks, J.D., Ph.D., Senior Lecturer, Executive Director of the Entrepreneurship and Innovation Program, Business College at the University of New Haven, high on the hill in West Haven. Brian, thank you. We'll be in touch. Have a good holiday. Stay safe, and we'll talk. Thank you.
Same to you, Paul. Take care.
Appreciate it. Dr. Brian Marks. Hurdles that schools have to overcome, the students and, of course, the teachers. And here representing the AFT chapter, the Connecticut chapter, the American Federation of Teachers, the local, is Union President Jan Hockadel, who returns for a visit. We spoke to her at the beginning of this, so we'll see how everyone is doing. Jan, Paul here again on WICC. How are you?
I'm doing great, Paul. How are you?
I'm doing okay, but I have to ask you a little further. How are you and your rank and file teachers and all the folks that the AFT Connecticut chapter represents? How are you really doing with this and dealing with all this that changes every day and hybrid and in class and out of class? What's the buzz?
I think you hit it on the head. It is changing every day. And our educators, and I say that, you know, not just teachers, but our paraeducators, everyone, they're doing their best to keep their head above water, so to speak. But it's getting more and more difficult, and it's getting more and more frustrating and more stressful, you know, because there isn't these statewide standards, which we're asking for. It's just, you know, some places or pockets are doing really, really good stuff, and then others are just struggling. And I think, you know, it's those disparities that are causing a lot of stress and anxiety for our educators.
Yeah, let's talk about the little bit of a controversy I know that's brewing with all the unionized teachers, you folks and the folks in the CEA as well, the NEA chapter here in Connecticut. Talk about what you would like to see a little more of, Jan, you know, from the governor and from the state government. You want a little more uniformity? Well, what are your concerns?
So, like I said, you know, health and safety is the most important thing to our educators now, you know, for the students, for the community, for themselves. And so there, you know, there are some excellent superintendents and administrators that are doing everything, you know, perfect. They, you know, they've kept their classes small. They're making sure students are wearing masks. People are in cohorts so that they're keeping the infection rates in their schools, you know, to a minimum. And we applaud that. And we're not saying that you should change anything if that's happening. What we're hearing from a majority of our educators, though, is that's not happening. You know, you have different standards in different schools, even sometimes within the same district. You know, if we don't have enough educators in the room, that we're asking for volunteers from the community to come in, why are we in school? That's not safe for anyone. If it's not safe enough for people to be in the schools, why are we asking for people out in the community to come in and they could possibly, you know, cause more infection? So I think it's that inconsistency that is really driving our latest petition that's going to the governor and asking for standards. If you have so many, in the beginning of the school year, there was a beautiful chart that said if you had so many cases within a 10,000 or 100,000, then, you know, this would happen. And then if you went past yellow, you went into this orange, things would happen. And that just doesn't seem to be happening anymore. And we're told, oh, well, that was a guideline. It wasn't really, you know, it was more of a suggestion. Well, that's very frustrating. I just feel like the goalpost just keeps getting moved all the time.
All right, I want to play off of that. Let's take a quick break. We'll come right back. Jan, stand by. Jan Hockadel is the guest. She is the president of the Connecticut chapter of the American Federation of Teachers, talking about teaching, what is going on. Unionized teachers in the state, they want a little more uniformity. We'll come right back with Jan first. Traffic and weather together, 5:36 on WICC. A lot of teachers, educators want a little more of a direction, a little standard tightening from the state government, Governor Ned Lamont. And we speak once again for a few more minutes to Jan Hockadel, who is the president of the Connecticut chapter of the American Federation of Teachers, one of two teachers unions in the state. So, Jan, dovetailing off of what we were talking about before the break there, so initially, you, your educators, your teachers, everyone you represent in the rank and file, you were kind of good with the initial roadmap that was set out, correct?
Yeah, at least we had a guiding document that we knew it to expect.
So you
and unfortunately,
had that... I'm sorry, go ahead, finish it.
And then unfortunately, that just doesn't seem to be followed anymore. And, you know, when we talk to people from the commissioner's office or the governor's office, they're saying, well, that was really just a guideline. We really don't want to hold people to that. We want to give the districts the authority to work with their own department, DPHs, and to figure out what's best for their students. Because, you know, don't get me wrong, everybody thinks that in-person learning is the best way to go.
Sure.
And we understand that they want to keep these students in school. The difference in opinion comes in is they're saying, you know, it's the safest place for students to be. And I'm not sure that our educators agree with that. First of all, I don't think they're doing enough testing to actually determine if that's true or not. You know, we see a lot of these charts that show, you know, students aren't getting the COVID symptoms, but that doesn't mean that they're not carrying them. So I think we're asking for more testing, more tracing. We're asking for more communication when that happens. And then, you know, set guidelines on quarantining. And if you have too much of the staff, and I don't know what that percentage would look like, but that cannot be in school, then we need to do remote learning until we can get everybody, you know, safe and healthy into the classrooms.
And I remember that one of your concerns, which obviously I would imagine, Jan, is an ongoing concern, is that you have many of your educators, teachers, and assistants, whatever, who are up into that kind of danger area, late 50, early to mid 60, some of your veteran teachers. And if they have to stay home for 2 weeks, everybody gets strained. It's kind of like a domino theory, because I know you and the other union leaders have said, well, the kids may be fine, but we just don't have enough teachers there.
That's right. That's right. And it's even not even more stressful, but it's also stressful for you to think about the younger teachers that may have children of their own, and they may work in a different district from the town that they live in. So you have your own children maybe, you know, have to be at home, but you have to be at school. It's getting very, very crazy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of these teachers are having to quarantine because of their own students. And then all of a sudden they're put out again for a second quarantine because of a classroom. It's getting difficult.
I have friends of mine who are teachers, relatives. I talk to them. I talk with a gentleman. Actually, I was out walking the other night and passed by an outdoor restaurant. We connected on something. So, you know, we talked about it. And what I ask them is, and what they respond to, is a concern, Jan, that between the kind of the chaotic, as we did as best as we can do, second half of last year, and now the first half of this year, there is a bit of a concern. They tell me, I'd like to know what you think about it, from the purely educational standpoint, that with the chaos we had last year, and now I know we're doing better this year, but what is the level of concern as to whether or not these kids in this changing environment are actually learning and keeping up with what they need at a certain grade level?
And that's always been a concern, like, you know, and that's why I think any educator will tell you that, you know, of course, in-person learning is the best option that we have. It wasn't great in different districts last year through the spring because it, you know, it was the have and the have nots. You know, there were districts that had programs and funding that they hit the ground running with the remote learning and they did fantastic work. And then there were other districts that just they did not have the funding and they did not have the structure. And it was very, very difficult. Hopefully over the summer, they were supposed to put together plans and submit them to the State Department on how they would overcome some of those issues that they worked on. And so I have to believe that it's better. I don't hear half as many cases mm-hmm. of, you know, just these missing students. And I do think that, you know, a lot of these schools are now in the hybrid model where, you know, they go to school 2 days and then they're home for probably 3 days or vice versa. And I think, you know, when you have that type of situation, you know, the students are in class, they know what they have to do when they're, you know, in the meantime, when they get back to the next class now. It's not that they're just out there and they're missing for, you know, months on a time. It's okay, I know next week when I come back into this classroom, I have got to do X, Y, and Z. And so they're more accountable too. So I don't think we're seeing the widespread difficulties that we did last spring.
I have also been told, Jan, and you can verify this or not, that the internet arrangement is better with more hotspots, and the logon numbers are actually, I've been told by my friends and relatives, are pretty good considering in this present time. Is that true?
Yes, that, the same thing. I mean, I'll admit there were some horror stories to begin with at the beginning of the year. But again, you know, they had to work through those. And I think safeguards were put into place now. So it's more efficient. And, you know, like you said, I think the internet is more available. We also think that more of our students have accessibility to technology. Mm-hmm. So it's rough working through it, but I do think we're getting there.
Let me finally, in the couple of minutes we have left, let me give you an opportunity to talk about vaccinations here. And I, in fact, Jan, I had a call from a listener yesterday. Once we carry the governor's remarks live about, you saw the framework, who's going to get first vaccines, you know, healthcare workers, nursing home workers, first responders. We can all agree on that. I had a caller yesterday who said, where do teachers fall in this? And are teachers considered, you know, there was another category the governor put up there of vital workers or something like that, or critical employees. What are you hearing about this?
Actually, we haven't heard a lot. We haven't had those discussions, and we do have quite a few discussions with the commissioner, who's been, you know, he's been right there working through a lot of these issues with us. We haven't started really having those type of conversations yet. I do expect them to come. I do expect, like a lot of things, it's going to be controversial because there are going to be, you know, folks that say, you know, you must be vaccinated, and then people are going to say, no, you know, it has to be a choice. So I do think that that's going to be an issue we're going to have to work through.
And so you do have to work through the actual thing of union members and educators in your union who may feel comfortable with not getting a vaccine as many people that want it on the other side, correct?
That's correct. It's that's one thing that this this virus has done. It has definitely shown, you know, lots of different opinions on everything, you know, from the homeschool, remote learning to the vaccinations. There are people all over the spectrum. And it's really, we always just have to go back to that same question. You know, what is best for the health and the safety of everyone that's concerned?
Jan Hockadel, thank you so much. Jan Hockadel is the president of the Connecticut chapter of the American Federation of Teachers. Jan, be good. Happy holidays, and we'll talk down the road. Thank you.
You too, Paul. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Appreciate it. There you go. Well, yeah, they got to work all this out, including maybe some teachers, you know, do not want to get vaccinated. What does the union do? Do they make it mandatory? Do they not make it mandatory? Does the state say all the teachers have to be vaccinated?